They're gonna kill the love of my life.
Casey!
If I don't go back to what I was doing.
On February 24th.
Our line of work is quite brutal and quite ruthless.
How far would you go for love?
You steal a truck, bring it to me. Then you make your money.
Is it dangerous?
Of course it's dangerous!
Nicholas Holt, Felicity Jones, with Ben Kingsley and Anthony Hopkins.
All this trouble, all this pain, for love.
Collide, in theaters February 24th. Rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday, February 18th, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. We've talked a great deal about wisdom traditions and incorporating yoga, meditation into our lives. And, we live in a very complex world. There's a lot of stress, a lot of illness. And the outcome for those of us who don't take care of our body, mind, and spirit, there's disease. Case in point, I recently traveled to Paris, and I was before I got on the plane, I was suffering from an ear infection. And as a kid, I had earaches constantly. And what the resolve was to get antibiotics. And, you can use antibiotics quite frequently, but at some point, you can become resistant to antibiotics. And I had had a great deal of success with Chinese medicine, various aches and pains, using acupuncture and herbs. So rather than going to the doctor when one of my ears flared up, and you don't want to get on a plane if you have an ear infection of any kind, simply because the elevation and those pressurized cabins just wreak havoc on any kind type of ear problem. So I went to my Chinese doctor and I said, medicine doctor, and I said, hey, what do you got for this? And through a couple of different acupuncture treatments and some herbs, he cleared it up in about a week, which is about the same time frame that you deal with when you're dealing with antibiotics. But when you use antibiotics, you're not only destroying the unhealthy cells, you're destroying a lot of the good cells in the body, and that is not something you want to do because that opens you up to other problems. So the great success with Chinese medicine, remember Chinese medicine is about 5,000 years old. It's a very old tradition. Acupuncture is amazingly effective. So something to think about, something to consider, Chinese medicine. And man, my travel mate was telling me that she was wondering how it was going because I was really uncomfortable for a while. And after a couple treatments, two acupuncture treatments and some herbs, although the herbs didn't taste great, the effect, the overall effect was very, very solid, and haven't had a problem since. So I have very, sensitivity to certain ear issues. So that is something to consider. Earth Ancients is sponsored by Gaia. Remember, Gaia has their special. You have access to 7,000 titles. Not a couple, 7,000 titles. And what they are offering right now is a series of programs. One is Greg Braden's Missing Links. There's also Linda Moulton Howe, who's presenting a whole series on the state of UFOs in the United States. And there's literally hundreds of topics that are fascinating, including the NASA's secret space program, a number of programs on the pyramid complexes around the world. And to get this access to this program, go to Gaia, GAIA.com/Earth Ancients. And you'll see a special page designed for you, the listener, gives you access to thousands and thousands, over 7,000 now, topics from around the world. Just 99 cents for the first month, and after that, it's about $9. Hey, and if you don't like it, you can pull out, but it's a pretty good program, really, and I suggest you try looking into it.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
And there's a lot to talk about right now, especially in Central America. A LIDAR scan was passed over this area called El Mirador, which is one of the largest Mayan ruins in Central America. In fact, Dr. Richard Hansen will be my guest March 4th. He's the director of excavations for the entire site. And what they've discovered is the scan shows brand new, massive buildings, a couple of new pyramids, but very, very long roads, 150 plus miles of roads, canals, and a number of unknown structures. And I've placed the entire article and the scan on our Facebook page. And the title of the article is LIDAR Scans of El Mirador in Guatemala. And this is a technology that is really breaking a lot of ground, and more archaeologists, apologists, and other researchers are using this technology, which actually cuts through foliage to show what is on the surface of the planet. And these ruins are thousands and thousands of years old, and LIDAR is fascinating. It's just a real fascinating technology that really gives a full idea, a full spectrum of ancient buildings in different parts of the world. So you can see that on Facebook. Go to Facebook, Earth Ancients. Go to the group page. Also, our friend Hugh Newman has a new video that I've posted on the Facebook page on the archaeoacoustics involved in various megaliths in the Avebury, England location. And what that is showing is that special acoustic scientists are revealing that these megaliths actually repel and amplify sound. Now, that can be someone talking, that can be someone in a group making certain sounds. They don't actually know how this how the voice worked in these environments, but it's something that's very fascinating. And Hugh puts out really interesting videos that you can see on the Facebook page. So consider that that's something that's quite unique. And as always, I suggest that you go to the Facebook page to check out weekly activities, weekly news, as well as Earth Ancients' website, earthancients.com. And by the way, the newsletter has gone out. So if you missed the newsletter for February, get on there now. I will be sending it out again. That's a chance to get the Richard Casero ebook, the free ebook, which is called The Cathedral Code, where he talks about sacred geometry in cathedrals, which is quite fascinating. So earthancients.com. Register, and you'll be part of the second mailing of the newsletter. Pyramids are popping up all over the world, and last week, or a couple of weeks ago, we had Richard Casero talking about megaliths in Spain, and I had heard about these Spanish pyramids, Spain, but these Spanish pyramids are quite unique, and what we're finding out is there's not just a couple of pyramids. There are a number of pyramids. And I have placed a article and some of these photographs on the Facebook page that you can check out. And I was curious about who might know about these. And so I checked in with Dr. Carmen Bolter, who is the writer, producer of The Pyramid Code, which was a TV series on pyramids. And I wanted to know more about what she knew about it. And as it turns out, she actually had some information. And here's the conversation we had regarding Spanish pyramids. Tell me about these pyramids in Spain that you've discovered. I remember seeing one that was unearthed, but it was only they only showed the stonework on one side. And I can't remember what part of Spain it was. But what have you discovered?
Well, first of all, in the next in the town near Rondo, they've discovered all these megalithic building construction, and there's videos on YouTube from Q Newman. Mm-hmm. And then this is quite close to there. But basically, where I was going anyway, I was looking at a piece of property. I could see these windmills, and there's windmills all over Spain, granted. And then this woman, like, they said that this property is a 19th century restored farmhouse. And but then the reply from the real estate was Cadiz/Tarifa. And so then I get another email, Cadiz/Tarifa, because Cadiz is the closest town, city. Mm-hmm. And it's this woman saying, my name is Noah. I've contacted you because you're on the International Advisory Board for the Bosnian Pyramid Project, and I've made these discoveries that there's possibly as many as 20 pyramids here. And if you'd like to look at the pictures, let me know. And then she's like, would you consider coming here to take a look? I'm like, I'm going to be there in a couple of weeks. She's like, okay, you were already coming here. So I've got two 24-inch screens, so I had the property open on one, and then I had her thing with the GPS, and just above the first pyramid, I could see these windmills, and then I'm looking at the shape of the shoreline, and I'm thinking, the pyramid's in the backyard of the house I'm looking at.
Oh, so it's not really a big pyramid then, it's like...
No, they're very much like Bosnian pyramids, where they're pre-Diluvian, but then they head down, all the way down, it's like pyramid fields to Gibraltar. So here we are in our little Atlantean boats, come in through the Straits of Gibraltar, and you'd see them going up, 20 pyramids going up, if they're real. So I contacted Geoscans, and they did an initial scan and said, yeah, there's tunnels underneath. So Klaus Dana.
Klaus Dana's people. Okay, yeah.
Well, the thing is that I haven't done the discovery yet. I have to go and
oh,
see.
Okay.
And then you have to, if you're going to do the scan, I need €40,000 for the scan. So,
yeah.
But I mean, I'm the client at Geoscans if the money comes through. So no one else gets to do that. And they're looking for a project leader. And, you know, it means going to the government and talking to the Ministry of Defense. And that's what I had to do the aerial footage in Egypt.
Okay.
So, you know, I've got a great interest in that. The other thing, too, is that the energy is going to be circulating off them, whether they're opened or not, excavated or not.
Yeah, so you could be
measuring them. So I'm taking a big interest in it. I did announce it on Coast last week.
Okay.
Just as much as I've told you now. I mean, it's too soon to know.
Okay.
But they're popping up all over the place. Like Dr. Sam in Bosnia is up to 80,000 pyramids that he's seen. And, you know, he's got photographs of most of them.
That's funny, because when I had him on the show, I asked him to define these pre-Diluvian, pre-flood pyramids. And other than the shape, and of course, you have the advantage of having these scans to actually see tunneling or any anomalies within the shapes. What is the criteria for discovering these earlier pyramids that aren't really, they're more natural with man-made features within them?
Well, the criteria are straight sides, tunnel system underneath, which has to be man-made, water, somehow there's water.
So water is a criteria, interesting.
Water is a criteria, chambers inside, it's going to have some kind of quartz structure because it's a double helix under pressure. The quartz crystal has a double helix. When you put it under pressure, it creates pyramid energy.
Right.
And so it's going to be what am I saying? Granite, which has a quartz content,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
or something like that. Alignment, north, south, east, west. What am I up to? Five now. There's seven different criteria.
And so that is just a brief overview from Dr. Bolter. When I hear 80,000 pyramids, I have to wonder, wow, where are those pyramids? Now, we know in Central America, and the elders have told me this for years, that there's huge areas that have not been excavated simply because the Mexican government doesn't have the technology or the financing or the motivation to go and start excavating areas that come up on scans like the LIDAR scan or any other kind of scan. But this is something new to me, a Spanish pyramid, and we're going to learn more about it. Now, you can go to the Facebook page and see one of these Spanish pyramids. And the one that I show actually has true stone blocks on it. And they're very, very, very old. This, I mean, you know, 4,000, 5,000 years or older. Or as, you know, people, as Dr. Bolter said, pre-Diluvian, which would be pre-flood. That's 9,000 plus years ago. So, anyhow, there's a tremendous amount of speculation, and we're going to have Dr. Sam Osmanovich on the show in March to talk about some of these pyramids that he's discovered up and down Europe. So, again, go to the Facebook page and check it out. It's quite an interesting series of photographs that are put up there. Most of us are familiar with the story of Jesus of Nazareth, the biblical accounts of his life, and we gain an understanding about his life, how he was persecuted, sentenced to die on the cross, and according to the Bible, he dies, he's placed in a secret chamber, and later he's resurrected. And carries on his teachings for a period of time. Did he actually die? Or was there another form of resurrection that took place? Did he actually physically die? Or was it a spiritual death? And his physical body was alive? My guest today, Freddy Silva, has written quite an interesting book on resurrection. And it's a fascinating subject. We've had Freddie on before, and we were just talking before the show about his experience in the Great Pyramid and the chamber, and maybe that was a space for initiation too. This new book's called The Art of Resurrection, Initiation, Secret Chambers, and the Quest for the Other World. Freddie, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on again, Cliff.
Real pleasure. Was this book kind of a focal point from your experience in the Great Pyramid and being in that chamber and experiencing those odd and kind of strange effects?
You know, in hindsight, I think these things happen for a reason. It's as a researcher, you sort of try to keep an open mind, you try to keep a balanced point of view, and you know, and remove yourself from the equation as much as possible, so that your personal opinion doesn't really come into your work. And I think a lot of people that read my books kind of get a sense of that it comes from a neutral point of view. But you know, the more I look back at my life and my experiences and how things seem to evolve into the next project, I begin to realize that yes, what I experienced inside the Great and the King's Chamber with three other people, and none of us were actually went there to get an experience. We just went there to clean up the place. I belong to a small group of people that go around the world, you know, cleaning up sacred sites whenever we are guided to do so by someone who's a very highly regarded psychic, and that even the police work with in Britain. We're just directed to go and clean things up, you know, because sacred sites are living beings. I mean, they are entities that live and breathe. They are organic structures, and they've been proven to be as such because of the way that we have the technology to show that they do have certain frequencies and energy that do congregate throughout the day, and they basically dissipate throughout the day, and they regain the strength back at dawn. So if you take your pollution into these places, your thoughts, your energy, your emotion into these buildings, they pick up on that. And once in a while, groups like us have to go and clean them up. And but I wasn't really expecting the fact that when we began to sort of tone in there, that we saw in complete darkness about 33 very tall people coming out of the actual stones and surrounding us, which...
I remember you talking about that. That must have been just so shocking.
No, it was exhilarating. I mean, it was so... it was so loving as an experience, and it's hard to put this into words, that I was just so overwhelmed by it. I thought, I hope this keeps going, because I've got so many questions I want to ask, but at the same time, I'm toning. I'm doing the work that I'm supposed to be doing, and so are we. And 20 minutes later, it's all gone, and we're just looking at each other going, did that really happen? With regard to your question, yes, I think that it was a prelude to the work and to try to understand what many of these ancient places were all about, because we do realize that sacred sites fulfilled many functions. They act as astronomical sites. They're obviously aligned to certain constellations. They're places of gathering and also of intense energy. But never in my life would it occur to me that there's this consistent relationship between certain sacred sites around the world, the Great Pyramid being one of them, and this unusual and very secret ritual called the resurrection ritual, or as the early Christians called it, the living resurrection. And when I was researching the material for my fourth book on the Knights Templar, that came up again, that the Templar Knights, the inner brotherhood, had this unusual thing of going to these secret underground chambers under their buildings, and they would return as the living or the risen. And I thought, what does this have to do with early Christianity? Because the Templars really gave Jesus no attention. I mean, their hero was John the Baptist and Mary Magdalene, and they dedicated all their churches to these people. And that's kind of how the story began to evolve. I began to realize that there's a bigger story going on here than the one that we've been told in the Western world about the meaning and the context of resurrection.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, you write that this ancient art of resurrection is a worldwide tradition. Actually, you literally go around the world and pick various cultures and describe their form of it. Do you believe this is a handed down or oral tradition? And how do you think it got dispersed throughout the world?
It is fascinating. It sort of goes hand in hand with things like the flood myths and creation myths. Mm-hmm. And whether you're talking to people in Polynesia or Armenia or the ancient Christian world and or Central America, where I've just come from, they have very, very similar stories. And again, you have to wonder, was there a certain central point for diffusion, like the flood myths? And I'm beginning to recognize that at some point someone was borrowing from the same book, because the rituals are so similar to each other. They follow the same procedure of, if you and I wanted to be part of this initiation. And by the way, it's worth pointing out as well that the true meaning of initiation literally means to become conscious. And once you understand that, you're on a completely different level of understanding. So if you and I wanted to go into become conscious and be more aware of the bigger picture of how things truly are than as to how they're perceived, we'd join a secret society. And there's nothing nefarious about it. The reason why it was secret is because they held certain pieces of information which, if misused, could be very damaging to the self. We're talking about methods of out-of-body experiences and induced near-death states, things which on the face of it sound very dangerous, and they are if they're not done correctly. So the reason why they were secret societies is because you had to go through the paces. You had to undergo a year of observation to make sure that you were actually, technically and spiritually and also mentally capable of going through all of this. And a further 2 years of actually understanding the bigger mysteries and also training your body for the final moment where you do spend 3 nights in an induced near-death state, either under the ground or inside a stone box or an earthen mound. And then 3 days later, you literally come back out from the dead. You've crossed into the other world. And you come back completely aware of where you've been and what you've done, who you've met, what you've learned. And that was the big thing, the big point of doing this. The ritual, this entire ritual I've just described in a very simplistic manner, you tell this to any culture around the world and they'll just nod and agree because that's how they've always done it. It's the same concept. They even had the same overarching goddess that presides over the same chambers. So again, where does it come from? And I'm sort of still scratching my head about that. But what is amazing is that the similarity with which all of these cultures seem to read from the same common source.
I think it's fascinating, the whole idea of a living resurrection rather than the fable of death and then the body resurrects itself in some form and becomes a ghost and comes back. So you've described
exactly.
You've described what a live resurrection is. Would you say that it was made more for a priest class, or you've described somebody had to go through a couple of years of initiation, cleansing, mental cleansing, physical cleansing. I would imagine some kind of spiritual cleansing. But what would you say the target was? Who was the person targeted? It wasn't for a regular Joe, was it? Or was it somebody who was evolved to the level where on some kind of a conscious level they were able to take on this? Because it's not an easy thing. I mean, it's kind of a challenge to go through this initiation.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they would have adepts actually beating the hell out of you to simulate fear, because the whole idea was that you had to be in control of your fear. I mean, if you think about it, you're about to have an induced near-death state. And I've spoken to doctors who actually are, who specialize in these near-death experiences. And they can tell you it's a pretty harrowing experience when you do it involuntarily, let alone voluntarily knowing you're going to die and be in a comatose state. And you have to trust that the people who are handling the entire initiation process know what the hell they're doing. So it was amazing to me to find out that actually anybody could join. It was open to everybody who was actually curious. But at some point, around, I'd say about 500 BC, I'm starting to pick up bits of information because this stuff isn't exactly written about in everyday books. You really have to go looking under some very strange rocks to find this stuff. The priest caste began to realize that this is a great way to actually control people. And because, you have their life in the palm of your hands, so to speak, and that exerts a huge amount of power in the ego. And that's where you start seeing that bridge into religion and organized religion, by which time we started getting into Christianity, early Christianity, which still maintained a very old tradition of this understanding until the fundamental Christians took over, and then it becomes the Catholic Church, and we know where that ended up. So it really was open to everybody else, and the Egyptians were also guilty of this as much as anybody else. You'd get one pharaoh who really understood the principles of the initiation, like people like Unas in 2600 BC, who actually did survive his own resurrection, and then he was buried in the pyramid next door to the pyramid that actually bears his name. So you have to wonder, why did this guy need two pyramids to bury himself with one body? And the answer was that, well, one pyramid was used for an initiation process. The other one was actually the burial chamber. So you're talking about something that was actually maintained for all the way through the Greek mystery schools for ordinary people who wanted to have an experience of the bigger picture. They wanted to empower themselves and discover who they really are. And the benefit ultimately was to live your life fully aware. You come back almost superhuman as a god. And the idea was that you have a certain amount of degree of control over the manifestation process. You have a certain degree of control over the forces and laws of nature. And that's very powerful stuff in the wrong hands. So they were very careful to protect this information to make sure it wouldn't end up in the wrong hands, which eventually, excuse me, is what happened with the Knights Templar. The church was basically after these secrets, and of course they died them. They died protecting these secrets to the grave. So we can see how this concept, and going back to your original question about Jesus, how this concept was mistaken by religious forces, and then two, misused to control the population. And if people just knew the true understanding of what resurrection really is about, they would be amazed to discover it is actually the most self-empowering tool you could possibly learn about.
Well, you just brought up one of my questions regarding the story of Jesus of Nazareth. Is it your belief that he did not die, that he was there's a story of him going to the Essenes and learning the sacred arts, the lost years of Christ? There's a number of books on this. But is it your belief that that he actually resurrected physically and not, as the Bible tells us, a spiritual resurrection?
Absolutely, and it's all based on fact, on the available facts. And the one thing that really sort of bugged me at the beginning of all of this was how do you reconcile the biblical version with the version that the early Christians were talking about, because the two were completely at odds with each other. Now, having been raised originally as a Catholic, and I had no chance, I was born in Portugal, you have to be raised as a Catholic, the story actually never actually sat well with me, even as a child. There's something not quite right about it. And you know, truth has a ring to it, and this just wasn't ringing true. So I began to go into an area that I really did not want to explore, which is early Christianity, and it's a huge subject. And luckily, people have done their homework and were able to help me, and one of them was Michael Bagent, the late Michael Bagent, who was a theologian, a historian, and he did a lot of work on that to understand how do you reconcile the fact that the early Christians, and specifically the apostles Thomas and Philip, who wrote two of the most, open-minded Gnostic Gospels that you could possibly read, which were anathema to the church, even to this day, because they undermine the very basis of the Catholic Church by saying that the whole concept of the resurrection was completely taken out of context. In fact, if any, I think it was Philip who said, if anyone actually believes in the anybody getting up, being nailed to a cross and then rising after physically dying, is mistaking a spiritual truth with an actual event. And that's where the shoe dropped. I began to realize that the reason why the Catholic Church was persecuting everybody, and I began to inquire as to the reason why, and look at all of these people that they were persecuting. And the one thing that they all had in common, including the Muslims, they all agreed that Christ never died physically on the cross. The whole thing was a metaphor for this incredible initiation, which the church didn't really know about. So which brings us to the point, how do you reconcile all of this concept that Jesus actually met a metaphoric death? It was a spiritual raising that he experienced, which is a story that was really borrowed from India in 6000 BC. The story is very, very old. And Bajan came to the rescue here by saying that there's an agreement that was made between Joseph of Arimathea, Jesus' uncle, with Pilate and the Roman authorities, because Jesus had not broken any actual Roman law. Therefore, he could not be crucified. The Romans actually were at pains to point out, we can't crucify this guy. He has broken no law. And it's actually a historical fact. And what Bajan was able to pull together from available information was that the actual physical embodiment of the resurrection was a staged event on Joseph of Arimathea's land. The closest witnesses were over a quarter of a mile away. And in the shimmering heat of the Jerusalem era, anything could be happening a quarter of a mile away, but you can't see clearly when you've got that shimmering heat coming off of the desert. And, you know, he was bound to a cross. He was drugged, of course, and then brought back from a near-death experience by a very clever woman who herself had been initiated because her name was Mary Magdalene. She understood the power of herbs, how some herbs are used in the process to induce a near-death state, and some herbs are used to bring you back from a comatose state. We know these today. And, of course, her teacher was John the Baptist, who himself was also part of that mystery school's tradition. So that answers the two questions quite nicely. There were two events. One was a spiritual resurrection, which is part of this long, thousands of years old initiation tradition. And the second one, to appease the Jews who were after Jesus, was a mock execution, after which he was taken down, put into a grave. And, of course, lo and behold, he's disappeared 3 days later. He's literally risen from the dead, and he goes walk about. Apparently in Persia and also in India, where he dies at a grand old age of 80, according to the local legends. And at that point, I give away my authority to somebody else.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. You know, you have to wonder, and I'm not anti-religion. I just don't follow it. I've always questioned the Bible from a very young age, and the whole notion of the spirits and I mean, commands to do things that follow a certain religious path. But is it your belief that the church in some form did recognize the resurrection as, in their eyes, a misunderstanding of what the true design for it was, and to possibly suppress this information? Because when you raise your consciousness, you raise into a whole different level of understanding, and those who have been meditating for years understand this. Would you say that it's a kind of a control factor in the way they wrote it, or just out of ignorance?
I think it's both. I think it's a fact that, and this can be easily proved, the Emperor Constantine was being forced to acknowledge Catholicism as the true religion, and of course he was a follower of Mithras, who, as it turns out, was a Romanized version of a Persian god-man who had gone to the sacred mountain, taken a narcotic, had a near-death experience on the winter solstice, comes back 3 days later, raises from the dead, called Mithra. And I've traced that story to India in 6000 BC of this resurrected god-man. And he has a second coming, surprise, surprise, on the spring equinox. So we can see how the whole story of Christ was literally the exact story of Mithra. In fact, even the Hindu god Krishna, there are 146 similarities between the story of Krishna and Jesus. So what Constantine essentially did to get these people off his back was to basically say, you know, I'm fed up with this. I'm just going to basically take Mithra out of the story and put the word Jesus in, and that's where we get the whole story of Christianity that we have today. So that's point one. Point two was the fact that this was a secret ritual, and the people who were in control of this, which at the time would have been people like the Essenes or the Mandeans, and people of the ancient Greek mystery schools, they were all highly persecuted because they wouldn't allow anybody from the fundamental Christian doctrine to actually come in and learn about this, because they recognized that these people want a certain power of control. This is not what it's about. It's about knowing more about yourself. And when you come back with this information, not only do you become a better person, you also help those around you, and everybody gains from this. It's a self-perpetuating system of mythology. It's a practical spirituality, if you want to call it that. And the church, I suspect, got their backs up on this, and they recognized that, well, we can't join them. We might as well beat them. And they basically end up persecuting everybody that wasn't following the same doctrine that they were postulating, which was, you know, Jesus died on a cross for our sins, and if you want to talk to God, because he was the Son of God, you'll have to talk to us and pay us for that privilege. Well, everybody else was saying completely different. They're saying, well, no. God is not an exterior force. God is an interior force. You are a God. You are part of that God. And if you have this experience, this initiation, you come to understand your godliness, and therefore there is no division between you and the other world. You are one spiritual being. And the church, of course, couldn't have this because you have to pay these guys with, you know, wearing long dresses and red slippers a lot of money to stay in power. It's a very simple sort of power grab, if you like, when it comes down to it. But in order to perpetuate the system, they had to basically manipulate Jesus into being a god, which, of course, Jesus never said that himself. In fact, when you talk about the Bible, the Bible is very interesting if you look at it from an initiate's point of view, and then it makes sense. And for example, Jesus' story about being the Son of God, actually, it's not that far from the truth, because that actually betrays the actual level of initiation he had achieved. This comes from the Essene tradition, where you join the inner brotherhood as a son of a woman. That's your first level of initiation. You graduate to become son of a man, and then you proceed up the ladder to become a son of the gods. And if you do succeed in having the living resurrection ritual, you are deemed risen from the dead, then you become son of God. You are literally now become a mirror image of the creative force of the universe. So in calling Jesus the Son of God, they actually betrayed his very highest level of initiation, letting the cat out of the bag. But only if you, on the inside, do you understand that code. Otherwise, it's totally meaningless.
That's fascinating. Well, the other thing is, in certain levels of consciousness, you are connecting with the God mind. So that could be an interpretation of becoming godlike, or the son, one of the sons of the gods, or a relation in some way, which is just misinterpreted in the Bible, which is fascinating.
Absolutely. And you see this recorded also on temple walls around the world. I mean, there's some in the Maya lands. Chichen Itza, for example, there is actually an inscription on one of the hidden chambers there, which was also used for the living resurrection ritual, by the way. And it says, you know, we built this place so the person can enter to become as a god, as a bright star. And what they meant by that is that when you are risen and you stand on top of the pyramid at on the winter solstice or the spring equinox, the first star that you see when you come out of this chamber, still groggy from your experience, is, of course, the heliacal rising of Venus, which, again, is another tradition that is done all around the world. That's the first bright object that the initiate sees upon his or her initiation. And again, it shows you that a lot of these places, a lot of these temples were designed for that purpose.
Yes, and you describe that in your book. Let's talk about the conditions for a resurrection. You outline a variety of buildings and structures designed for the initiatives to go into. What are the specific conditions within these buildings that are built in that kind of induce this consciousness change?
It actually goes back to my earlier work and looking at megaliths and how they work and why people get these unusual out-of-body or even spiritual experiences at ancient sacred sites. And it has a lot to do with the piling up of rocks and the specific choice of rock, and that is the high amount of quartz and a specific amount of quartz of that, and also the fact that a lot of these rocks are packed with magnetite. Now, when you put all of these things together, you begin to create a certain electromagnetic environment around you. And we do now know that it only takes a certain change in the local electromagnetic environment to alter a person's state of consciousness. The second one is the fact that you also find these places, these buildings, man-made caves, pyramids, and so forth, at the intersecting lines of the Earth's electromagnetic grid. So you've got that as well going on and harnessed at these locations, which means that you, as an electromagnetic being, are being influenced by something that's already within yourself. Then you have the fact that all of these sites are all built above sources of water, which, when you add electromagnetism to it, further accentuates the electromagnetic spectrum around that site. And, of course, you and I are made of two-thirds water. So in a sense, these buildings are designed to mimic the human body in every single way. And if you go around the world looking at all the places that were built by people, and most of them were trying to mimic the sacred mountains where these initiations used to take place under exactly the same conditions, you'd essentially have an underground chamber or someplace where the light does not penetrate. And the reason for this is because it generates a lot of DMT in your body, and that allows that chemical to generate certain visionary environments. But this vision is not coming from an exterior source. It's actually coming from within yourself. You're stimulating your own chemistry to allow you to see and pierce the veil through the other world. Wow. And sometimes they would actually design sarcophagi, and we have seen a lot of cases in Egypt, for example, where pyramids off Giza were found completely sealed. The chambers were sealed. The archaeologists go in. They find a beautiful sarcophagus of extraordinary craftsmanship. They open the lid, and lo and behold, there's nobody inside. So they built these specific boxes at huge expense in order to, again, put the initiate inside a certain rarefied environment that would lessen the weight of the physical body in order for you to have an out-of-body experience. And they were very adamant about this. You had to fast for a certain amount of time. You had to make your body as absolutely light as possible. You had to mentally prepare yourself. And then, of course, you had to take this special narcotic, and I keep coming across references of all kinds of interesting narcotics around the world, whether it's Syrian rue in Persia, to this very day in Central America. They also have an administer, and I hasten to add that I did take a small libation when I was in Central America just for purely research reasons. and they, to this very day, still make it in the traditional way. They actually carve an actual tree in the shape of a boat because it's supposed to symbolize the solar boat that you're about to take to get you across the Milky Way to the center of Orion. Now, an Egyptian would totally understand that because it's connected to the myth of Osiris, who, of course, is one of the earliest versions of Jesus. And that is that, you know, on the winter solstice, he dies, has his body chopped up by 72 co-conspirators, which makes you wonder, why does it take 72 people to chop up a guy? And, of course, he gets reconstituted by his divine virgin, his wife Isis, and he comes back as a palm tree, the symbol of the resurrected man, which, of course, then gets attached to the story of Jesus 8,000 years later. So the chamber would have all of these associations going with it. And finally, it has to usually be aligned east-west because you have to basically follow the path of the balanced light, which is the equinox, when light and dark are at their perfect balance. And you follow the path into the west, and all of these sacred sites have either entrances, chambers, or rooms, all pointing towards the west. And then when you are risen and taken out of the box or these chambers, you come back to the east. You face the risen, balanced light of the spring equinox, and that's when you declared risen from the dead. So you have this technology, this spiritual technology, which is found again and again and again in many cultures around the world. And most of these people were not supposed to ever have been in contact with each other.
It's fascinating that you describe this electromagnetic discharge being a component to these chambers. I find that fascinating because we're discovering with our growing technology that many of these pyramid cultures built these pyramids in these chambers with those properties built into them, which is fascinating. And we don't know how they were used. This is one aspect. I think you're showing us this is one aspect of how they may have been used. But the more our technology grows, the more we can scan these buildings. And who knows if their technology was just intuition. They had a higher sense of conditioning where they could tell where was higher frequencies here and there. But to understand that these buildings had this electromagnetic energy in them is just it's kind of mind-blowing, isn't it?
I think you actually touched on a point right there. I mean, where did they borrow this stuff from? I mean, I think this all comes from a time when we were less enamored with the physical world and much more concerned with how nature works. And I think we were much more observant as human beings. And there are also, of course, you know, 150 flood myths at least around the world that talk about unusual people that survived, and they brought with them this understanding with them, the harmonizing of the laws of nature and the bending of such in order to elicit a certain effect, whether it's levitating stones or allowing for an out-of-body journey so you can get a full understanding of how the universe really works rather than that it is perceived, which then enables you to live your life with a degree of control and awareness, which is what the purpose of living is all about, rather than living your life from day to day thinking that there's nothing more than a drudgery and you end up with the wrong people in power, the wrong presidents, and you're sort of blaming everything in yourself. But that's not the point of the experience. The experience is to live your dream awake, and any technique that you can use to do that, so much the better. Today we have shamanism, which is not quite the same as a living resurrection for a number of reasons, but there's a reason why it's become so popular. And yet this technology seems to be coming out from an age where people did appear to have a total control of the laws of nature, and sometimes they'd sort of mess it up too. I mean, if we look at the Puranas of India, they do talk about the wars of the gods, where they appear to be misusing all kinds of natural laws to create all kinds of havoc on the face of the earth. And then, lo and behold, you have the big flood caused by a disintegrating meteorite impact, which we can now accurately date to 9703 BC. So I think this comes from a very, very long time ago, where we did acknowledge that, yes, we do have the God-given ability to access another level of non-physical reality and bring back information that is of use.
Let me ask you a question, and I don't know if you meditate or not, but I do meditate, and a number of our listeners do meditate.
Hopefully not during this program.
Well, here's the question. How do you compare your understanding of the living resurrection with somebody who is a longtime meditator and various sages and yogis have talked about deep connection with the higher levels of consciousness through aspects of meditation? Would you say that it touches upon the resurrection effect, or would you say that it is a weak version of it?
I think it's intertwined. In fact, there's a wonderful aphorism written on the Temple of Edfu in Egypt, which actually sums it up quite nicely. And it says, we would keep building temples until people recognize they are the temple. And the temples were essentially built as mirror images of the cosmos and of nature. And they had exactly the same energy enhancements as you find in natural living temples that you find on the landscape, say, in New Mexico, where you have Shiprock, the most sacred site of the Anasazi. That is a landscape temple, just as a pyramid is a man-made version of that particular site. And the idea is that if you forget how to do this for yourself, you can go to these places and experience the process under certain conditions. Now, if you talk to people in India, they will say, well, actually, you can do this for yourself by using various forms of meditation. And one of them, of course, is the total harnessing of the body's electrical circuits, which comes through a practice of something called Kriya Yoga. And in India, of course, they laugh at the Western people when they talk about, I do yoga. And they'll say, no, that's not yoga. Yeah. This is yoga. Right. And I'm being very generalistic about this, of course, because there are people here, of course, in the West that do know how to do yoga properly. But they were very keen on understanding the process of Kriya Yoga specifically as a way to manipulate your body's electrical circuits to bring them under your conscious control. And if you do this enough, you will also have an out-of-body experience, and you'll have a very similar process to the living resurrection ritual. And the same thing also comes through meditation. I was reading a very interesting book by a guy called Paul Brunton, whose work I adore, and he was asking the same questions in the 1920s. He became very cynical about modern life, even back then, and he went walkabout in the East and in Egypt, and his writings are wonderful, and they parallel a lot of the stuff that I'm writing about. In fact, we also saw the same people in the inside the King's Chamber, which is extraordinary. I hadn't read his story before that.
You mentioned him the last time we talked. Yeah, it was fascinating. He's the one that, wasn't he locked in the King's Chamber for a period of time or something? Quite fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, back then you could pay a reasonable amount of backsheesh and get the building to yourself for the entire night. And he was able to go walkabout inside the entire thing. So he took it a stage further. We only had 2 hours. Actually, no, we had about 20 minutes. So The point being that he went on to write about meditation and the fact that when you actually learn how to do it properly, it is an initiation experience. And he talks about and describes in vivid detail his meetings with real rishis and yogis who, for days and sometimes weeks, would be sitting there cross-legged with their eyeballs rolled behind their head and completely gone. I mean, they'd be talking to this guy, they'd be taking photographs. This person was completely out of body. And then he'd come back a week later and admonish these people for taking photographs while he was meditating because he could see everybody from outside of his own body. He'd left his physical self and gone walkabout in the other world. So, yes, you can do it. There are other techniques that are available, and I think we should look into them very seriously.
Let's talk about the levels of consciousness that the initiatives go to. You describe the other world as a place that the initiatives would connect with different aspects of consciousness. What is the other world?
Well, the other world is basically everything that exists beyond the level of physical reality. And there are slight variations when you travel, say, from Central America to Persia, to Egypt and China. They have tiny, tiny little local variations, but essentially they all agree that it covers everything when you basically are able to leave this threshold while you're still in a living, breathing body. And the idea is that this is a sort of a big astral reference library where everything that exists has to exist and is existing already exists at the same time. It's a paradox to the human brain. You have to get your head around the fact that everything in this other world exists in four dimensions. Time is simultaneous. Color is very vivid. Sounds are very vivid. And you can literally be there for what seems like thousands of years, then come back and only 5 minutes have elapsed. It's a place where you can gather information, where you talk to people long deceased, heroes, gods. You can go into libraries and pick up information about things, have a certain sense of the prospect of future events, even though, of course, the future is pretty much modeled on the way that we manipulate and mess up the physical world and what happens down here. So it's never a certain a certain prediction in a future time is going to happen. They also describe it as a place where you pick up access to the fundamental laws of nature. And this is what a lot of philosophers like Pythagoras and Plato were very anxious to learn about. And they too went into this ritual of accessing the other world. And even Plato claimed at one point that it actually, his living resurrection experiences actually helped shape his philosophical and metaphysical doctrines. So you can see how potent this journey was for these people. Isaac Newton, I suspect, from reading between the lines, also was part of this group of people, which by then were called the Rosicrucians, who followed the same principle as the Templars. Da Vinci was certainly tapped into this, and you can see how through the work that they created that we know so well, what they were looking for and how it really helped to shape their doctrine and make them into the people that they are. So I would sort of, in a nutshell, I would describe the other world as being a big sort of library of information where depending on what you actually program yourself to do when you're still in that underground chamber or sarcophagus, you are very focused when you cross over, and that's where you are directing your consciousness in order to access a specific type of information, come back with it consciously, and then apply it on a day-to-day basis.
Would you say that that other world is what modern mystics call the Akashic Record area, where I think Blavatsky talked about that in her book, an area where you access everything that has been, currently is, and what will happen in the future? It's just a huge library. Is that kind of the same thing?
Absolutely, yes, it's the same thing. In fact, it reminds me of something that was written about by this clinical psychologist in L.A., and his name has just gone out of my head. He wrote The Destiny of Souls and Journey of Souls, I think it's Michael something, I can't remember. Anyway, but you'll know the title of the books because they're very famous. And this is a clinical psychologist who was really not interested in woo-woo or New Age. And he was amazed to find that when his patients sat on the couch and they were taken under, and these were people who were you know, people without any metaphysical tendencies. These were captains of industry who had big companies, and they went there to sort themselves out for smoking addiction, sexual addiction, drinking problems. And during his sessions with these people, they began to actually describe the other world in exactly the same way that I just have, that they'd be describing life between lives. They'd also be describing these rooms in these enormous sort of light mansions. Everything was built of light. And one of the stories stuck with me because it was something that we had also experienced in our meditations and the experiences in these temples. And that was that there are certain libraries where the information is held in these books made of these blue light, where everything that has existed and has yet to exist is written down in this language of light. It was wonderful for him to be extracting that from people in his consultancy in LA when we've been getting this stuff directly or indirectly through our experiences. And it was very much like that, that you do as a spirit being. And, you know, being in the physical body here, we're, our soul is not here fully. I mean, there's only about 30% of our actual soul inside our body at any given moment. The other 70% is actually going walkabout somewhere else in the universe. And that's something that's also Michael Newton, that's it, that's his name. That Newton was able to point out in his meetings with his clients that 60% of your soul, 70% of your soul is somewhere else in this astral reference library, making plans for another experience, another lifetime, sometimes even picking the experience that Cliff Dunning is having. And that's where this strange paradox comes in. Here you are living on this earth, and yet some soul is actually saying, this guy's having an interesting life. I haven't had that experience. I would like that. And you get together with your friends and your tutors, and you create what is about to become the life of Cliff Dunning. And yet, paradoxically, you haven't existed because you're about to become him. It's fascinating, and you have to get your head around this. But once you do, it begins to really make very concrete sense as to how the universe truly does work, and also explains where you go as a soul during your sleep and your meditations, that there is another level of existence that's equally as attractive, if not far more so, and much more coherent in the world that you're living in right now.
I think you just brought up something that's very, very important, and I believe this is the key to these pre-Diluvian cultures, is that they were in touch with the multidimensional self. The 60% that lives outside of us and has aspects and is in touch with spirit world, as you want to, if you can call it that, or these libraries, and had access to science that didn't use the technology that we have today, but probably access and knew how to imbue stone with knowledge like the Maya do and the great Egyptian, the pre-dynastic Egyptian. So very, very, very interesting. And this is a key, I think, that it's in your book that is an underlining fact. And my big focus in this time period is to understand how we can get back into understanding that and not suffer so much, because we all suffer so damn much because we're so locked into this we're hardwired into the physical. And yeah, it's amazing.
That's not the president I voted for. How
Uh-oh.
Did I end up with this mess?
Uh-oh.
It's true.
We don't want to get too
political.
I think
you're touching on the principal question of life, and this is something that was true today as it was 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 years ago. It's no different for these people than it is for us today. Even though they seem to be much more connected with the spirit of things, they have equally as biggest problems. I mean, we're living actually in very quiet political times where most of the world is actually at peace. If you don't believe what you read in the papers all the time, that, you know, we tend to get snippets of things, and that basically gives us the impression that somehow the whole world is a terrible place. But actually, 95% of the world right now is actually at peace, whereas, you know, only 3,000 years from now, you'd be lucky to be living where I am now and not be overrun by the armies of six different nations and warlords every other month. Those are pretty stressful periods. And I think that the search that we're doing today is equally true for these people. So it brings us back to the whole importance of the concept of living resurrection and initiation and taking the time out to understand and find a method that appeals to you, even if it's just sitting down and meditating for half an hour a day, that is your living resurrection experience. And the more you do it, the more, just like driving a car, the better you get at it, and the more automatic it becomes in your life. And before you recognize what's happened, it becomes your life. You become that special God that you are, that resides within you all the time and is itching to break out at every single minute of the day when you find inspiration and you wonder, where did that come from? Well, that's your God self talking to you, saying, you know, I can do a lot of interesting things. So I think it's a matter of finding the method that appeals to you. Like we were talking earlier, it could be Kriya Yoga, it could be meditation. It could be going on sacred sites tours. I mean, the people that I take, I just come back from Guatemala. We went to some of these temples where they practiced exactly what we're talking about. And there were people there, rulers there, that exemplified the teachings of the resurrection. One of them is the temple of Pakal at Palenque. And all you have to do is stand in front of that building without me saying a single word. And people in the group were saying, wow. And I said, well, that's interesting. Why would you say that? There's tons of buildings here. There's over 2,000 buildings of Palenque. Why that building alone? And they would say, there's something about it. I said, well, let me tell you what took place there and what the geometry of the building is and why the stone is there and where it is. It's eliciting a response from you, because the response is exactly designed to open up your body's electrical circuits to prepare you for this out-of-body journey. And Pakal actually did that. And it's, I think a lot of our listeners will remember the famous sarcophagus lid of Pakal that many ancient aliens, people will say that's an astronaut sitting on a chair looking at a telescope. It's actually it's a little sort of a naive view, because when you understand the imagery, you'll see exactly what it is. Pakal basically is the lord of the middle world. He's sitting on the this monster that has chewed him up in the underworld, or the other world as they call it in the Maya world. It's chewed him up. It's removed his physical self to expose his spiritual self. He's gone into the underworld to learn the mysteries of creation, come back to the middle world, and because he's applying them in his daily life, he is in control and is now looking at the heavens towards the other world. So he is in control of all three levels of reality. He's the true initiate who has risen himself. So the whole sculpture of this design takes on a whole new meaning when you see it that way. So again, just going to these sacred sites allows you to have that experience. And if I may just sort of say something to this, there was one experience that I was showing people. I like my tours to be experiential as well. There's one enormous standing stone at Yixtlan on the border with Guatemala. You have to get there through a crocodile-infested river, which makes touring so much more exciting. And there's one stela, and there's an engraving on it, and people are taking photographs, and I'm saying, okay, it's a nice stela, it has engravings. But how about this? Do you think that stone could be imbued with power and energy? And people are saying, well, yes, well, no. And I bring out my dowsing rods, because, you know, I don't like carrying around a $40,000 magnetometer to prove the same point. I actually show that there are waves of energy coming off the stone, and they're measurable in ripples. And we're sitting there with little pebbles marking the edge of the ripples. And again, you can do this with a magnetometer machine, and it has been done at several sacred sites. And then I said, okay, the stone itself has an energy coming off it. It's about 10 feet wide. Now, I want you all to give the stone some attention and some intention. And your intention is to give it a thought of love and ask the stone to demonstrate the power of your own being. And it takes about 5 seconds. And I start walking back 50, 60, 70 feet behind them. And they're wondering, what's he doing? And I get the rods out, and I measure the energy field. It's now expanded about 50 times, and you should see the look on their face. And this is the point that I was making. These temples are designed specifically with a spiritual technology that harnesses and bends the laws of nature, so you can be it can be demonstrated clearly to you that you are a god. You are also a bright star, and it's not that difficult.
That's a wonderful example of imbued stone, and I have had the same experience in the various Mayan ruins I've visited, Uxmal, Chichen Itza, the El Castillo. They used to be able to climb these these pyramids, they don't let you do it anymore, but you don't really need to. You're right. You could stand around the outer perimeter and still feel it. You're actually
bathed. Oh, absolutely.
That's
absolutely
fascinating.
In fact,
yeah.
That pyramid, which is, of course, dedicated to Kukulkan, it's the same person as Osiris. And if you get special access and you go into the inner chamber, and there are five pyramids in there, by the way, these things do grow over time in order to keep themselves aligned to certain solar events. But inside there is the throne of the jaguar, which, of course, is the symbol of the god-man who has basically harnessed his animal nature. And if you look at the images of Osiris as the initiate, he too is associated with Orion, as it is in Chichen Itza, and he too is wearing the leopard skin cloth of the initiate. So again, two cultures separated by time and space, and yet here they are practicing the same resurrection concept.
Do you believe that the Egyptian story of Osiris and Quetzalcoatl are actual stories of true people, or is it more of a mythology to bring about an understanding of the resurrection phenomenon?
It's actually both. They start off as myth, as a symbol. And of course, metaphors are huge in all of these stories. Everything is about metaphor, which is why the church got into so much deep water when it starts taking these metaphors as literal truth. And we end up with this problem we have today of the misconception of the story of Jesus, which is actually much more interesting than we've been led to believe. And yet, these are sort of universal concepts which are then described in a certain way and given a certain concrete form to give an abstract concept meaning in people's lives. Remember, a lot of these people were illiterate back in those days. They had to be given symbols, and that when you start concretizing abstract thoughts into and making them real by having, you know, people with animal heads on them, they get the point. They recognize that a certain person with a certain animal's head represents a certain concept, and that's how you taught people. And over the course of time, people who actually went through this initiation, they became as Kukulkan, as Quetzalcoatl, and as Osiris. So they actually were also real people. And sometimes, for example, in Central America, a lot of the rulers that did go and have this experience actually take on the name as one of their many names of Kukulkan or Quetzalcoatl. So that's where a lot of the confusion comes in with Orthodox archaeologists, because they say, well, this Quetzalcoatl guy, he actually did live in the 6th century. Well, yes and no. He took on the concept of Quetzalcoatl because he'd actually gone through the initiation ceremony. Therefore, he has the right to be given that name and to be included as part of his string of names. But originally, it was a spiritual concept.
Fascinating. In the final moments of our show here, I have to ask you this. What do you hope that people take away from this book? I mean, we've talked a lot of pretty high-level concepts, meditation, different levels of consciousness. What can someone gain? What do you hope that people gain from reading this book?
I hope that, first of all, that they actually begin to recognize the concept of Western tradition religious belief as being founded on very very shaky foundations. And sometimes people ask me, are you getting a lot of grief from Christians about this? And actually, I don't, because I'm not trying to dismiss Jesus and the whole concept of resurrection. I'm trying to show it in its proper context. And when you see it in its proper context, it's actually an extraordinary story. It's a very highly self-empowering story. And it makes the guy much more interesting in my eyes. What I am trying to do is, at the same time, expose organized religion for the bogus situation that it is. And I am backed in this by two of the original apostles, Philip and Thomas, who wrote two of the most damning books against the Catholic Church that you could possibly find, which is why they were banned, you see. That's on one level. The second level, I want people to get a clear understanding of initiation and what having this out-of-body experience is about, and also where to travel around the world to, you know, if you get the chance to go to some of these places that I list in the book. If you're lucky enough to do this and have a quiet time, and a lot of the times when people take people on tours, we actually do get a lot of quiet time, and we are able to have moments where we do begin to get a sense of what it would have been like to have that sort of connection with a bigger picture. and they come back to their daily lives much changed. So I hope that the information actually gets you to see things for what they really are, gets you to appreciate sacred space for what it really is and what it can do for you. And I describe these places as self-help centers, because when you do feel that the world is coming down on top of you and everything is falling around, you've got to remember that you are the temple. You are the original perfect temple. And if you feel that you're under attack, then take yourself on a trip. Go and stand somewhere on a sacred space and find time for yourself and recognize that you are a god, you are a bright star. And I hope that's the one thing that people will take from this, that it's a book ultimately about your divinity and your self-empowerment.
Fascinating. The book is The Lost Art of Resurrection, Initiation, Secret Chambers, and the Quest for the Other World. My guest today has been Freddie Silva. Freddie, thank you very much. Why don't you give us your website, and any information on that site that you think is pertinent?
Yeah, invisibletemple.com is the website, and you'll find there all my books, latest DVD on the secrets of the Andean temples, which actually goes into a lot of what we discussed today.
Yeah,
and how the pilgrimage from from Cusco all the way to Machu Picchu is much more than I was even aware of, and most of us are actually aware of. And having an understanding of this concept of living resurrection, the whole area of these sacred sites comes alive in itself. So I'm very excited about that new project. And also
fantastic.
About the tours that I lead to the sacred sites, a couple of which have a couple of openings to England and also to Scotland. So if you want to hang out with six people who want to have a great adventure, let me know.
Yeah, sounds excellent. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Freddie, and we'll look forward to hearing from you in the future.
Absolutely. Anytime, Cliff. Thank you.
Thanks. So that was Freddie Silva. This book is fascinating, and he touches upon a level of understanding that the ancients knew about. And I talk about it in the show quite a bit. Meditation, things have come forward, yoga, and we're learning more and more about various states of consciousness. This book is a great highlight to that whole concept, The Lost Art of Resurrection. So that was fun. Next week, we have a special guest talking about some evidence of very high culture thousands and thousands of years ago in California. And I won't mention his name yet, but I will tell you that he has discovered in a book writing in Southern California on various stone megaliths that he has just discovered. This is going to be coming out in his new book. The system that he's discovered in the writing. So that's next week on Earth Ancients. Have a great day. We'll look forward to having you back with us.
Napa Know How. A Napa guy knows more isn't always better, unless we're talking about full-size vans. These beasts do more than get you from A to B. They have so much space a man can live in it. With shag carpeting, waterbed, and a sweet lava lamp, these mobile abodes have all the comforts of home. With quality parts and plenty of Napa know-how, you can keep the original tiny house running longer, stronger. That's Napa Know How.
Napa Know How. Welcome to Staples.
Staples guy, this year I'm preparing my own taxes.
Good for you.
Yep, I'm going to be accountable.
Right. Well, Staples can help with storage and filing supplies, plus software like QuickBooks and TurboTax.
Go on. You have my interest.
And now get TurboTax for up to $15 off at Staples.
Up to 15 bucks off TurboTax? That'll pay handsome. Returns.
Right.
Thanks, Staples guy. Depreciate it.
Uh-huh.
Everything you need this tax season for less, like up to $15 off TurboTax. Staples. Make more happen.
In-store only. It's 417.